So the question arises, what is this path of regular steps? What is the path of irregular steps? And I propose to be a little irregular myself this evening and deal with the second first, that is to say, with the path of irregular steps first. Now, in order to understand this, in order to understand what the path of irregular steps is, we must look around us. Look around us not just at the great world outside, politically, economically, culturally, but just look around in our own Buddhist circle. Look around us at Buddhism as it actually exists in the Western world today, whether in this country, or Germany, or France, or Italy, or Hungary, or the United States of America. Look around at Buddhism as it actually exists in the Western world today. And when we look around, perhaps look around for the first time, what is it that we see? What do we see first of all? What do we encounter first of all? What is the most conspicuous feature of Buddhism in the West? What do we see first? Well, first of all, I think most of you will agree, first of all, we see books. Books. Books about Buddhism. Hundreds of books. And we see big books, and we see small books. Little pamphlets from the East, lavishly illustrated volumes from leading publishing houses in London and New York. We see very popular books, so popular that anybody can read and understand them, and very scholarly books, so scholarly that only perhaps two or three of us can follow them. We see books on the Theravada. We see books on the Mahayana. Of course we see books on Zen. Books on the Tantra. Books written by Buddhists of various persuasions. Books written by non-Buddhists. Books on Buddhism, that is, written by anti-Buddhists. And books written by all sorts of people who don't know where they are or what they are. Some of these books are original works, the product of much independent thought and study. Others are translations. Translations from Sanskrit, translations from Pali, Tibetan, Chinese, Japanese, Burmese, Thai, Sinhalese, French, German, Italian, Russian. There's hundreds and hundreds of books. And that's the first thing that we see when we look about us at Buddhism in this Western world. The first thing of which we become conscious, books. And at first, especially if we're young and enthusiastic, have lots of time, we start trying to read these books, if possible, all of them. Or at least as many as we can. At least some of the better known ones. And we usually, I think you'll agree, we usually read quite a lot. Quite a lot. Some of us may even get around to reading the scriptures. And in this way, by virtue of our reading, our very miscellaneous reading, reading all the books on Buddhism that we can possibly get hold of, we start forming an idea, an impression about Buddhism, even ideas about Buddhism. But we find, though we ourselves may not be aware of the fact, that our ideas about Buddhism derived from our reading about Buddhism are usually very confused indeed. We may say that they're so confused that we don't even begin to realize until years afterwards, in many cases, how confused they are. In some cases, we may never realize it. But meanwhile, we think that we understand Buddhism because we've read about it. We think that we know all about it. And if we're not careful, after a few years, we may be tempted to share our understanding, that is to say, our confusion, with other people. So we may be tempted to start writing and speaking about Buddhism, and in this way we may even become quite well known. We may even have 5 or 6 people, 10 or 12 people, sitting at our feet, listening to us, and drinking in our words of wisdom. And with a little luck, we may even appear on TV. With a little more luck, we may even be invited to represent Buddhism, whatever that may mean, at some inter-religious meet, somewhere in London. But all the time, what is really the position? The position is that we do not understand Buddhism at all. Now, when I say at all, I mean this quite literally. Not that we have a little understanding of Buddhism, that we've grasped just a portion of it. The position is we do not understand Buddhism at all. But we think we do. Now, a very important consequence follows. When we understand a thing, whether we really understand it or just think we understand it, when we understand a thing, we become, as it were, superior to that thing. Understanding means appropriating. It means taking the object of knowledge unto oneself. It means, as it were, taking it into oneself, making it one's own, a part of oneself. And for this reason, because understanding means appropriating, we speak in terms of mastering a subject. We speak in terms of mastering, say, accountancy, mastering mathematics. And we even speak, or at least think, in this of mastering Buddhism. So because we understand Buddhism, we think we understand, we think we have understood, because we've appropriated, made part of ourselves, we become, or we feel, sort of superior to Buddhism. We've incorporated it. We've made it part and parcel of ourselves. So we feel superior to Buddhism, and because we feel superior to it, because we know it, because we've mastered it, we don't look up to it. And because we don't look up to it, because we think we've understood it, we think we've mastered it, we don't feel towards Buddhism any real devotion, any real reverence. We're devoid of that. There's no feeling, no looking up, no warmth, no devotion, no reverence. We've just mastered the subject. Now, this kind of attitude is not new in this country, in the West. It's by no means confined to modern Western Buddhists. This sort of attitude has been widespread in the Western world for quite a long time. And 150 years ago even, we find the great poet and thinker, Coleridge, complaining about this sort of attitude, complaining, of course, within a Christian context. we find that on May the 15th, 1833, he delivered himself of these sentiments. He said, "There is now no reverence for anything. And the reason is that men possess conceptions only, and all their knowledge is conceptional only. Now, as to conceive is a work of the mere understanding, and as all that can be conceived may be comprehended, it is impossible that a man should reverence that to which he must always feel something in himself superior. If it were possible to conceive God in a strict sense, that is, as we conceive a horse or a tree, even God himself could not excite any reverence." And reverence, Coleridge goes on to say, is only due from man, and indeed only excitable in man, towards ideal truths, which are always mysteries to the understanding. For the same reason that the motion of my finger behind my back is a mystery to you now, your eyes not being made for seeing through my body. So this is what Coleridge said on this subject of lack of reverence 150 years ago. And at about the same time, we find, in Germany, an even greater poet, an even greater thinker, saying much the same thing, but rather more briefly than Coleridge. We find Goethe in his Reflections and Maxims saying, "The finest achievement for men of thought is to have fathomed the fathomable and quietly to revere the unfathomable." So we may say that it is this quiet revering of the unfathomable, that which cannot be understood, cannot be comprehended, which is atakavacharo in Buddhist terminology, beyond the reach of thought, beyond the reach of understanding, of conception. It's this quiet revering of the unfathomable that, until recently, has been so lacking among Western Buddhists. We may say that we've been much too quick to understand, much too ready to speak even about the unfathomable. In fact, we can even say that we've been much too ready to speak especially about the unfathomable.